On this Thursday, May 21st, welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. The U.S. is now facing the worst labor market since the Great Depression back in 1929, with the official unemployment figure already at over 20 million, representing a total loss of all the jobs gained since the Great Recession of 2008. There's a new report out today from Columbia University indicating that if the state and federal governments had acted sooner, potentially as many as 36,000 fewer people may have died from coronavirus. A new poll, one snapshot in this presidential election, showing that President Trump is slipping nationally as he travels to battleground state Michigan. And in Texas, the FBI is investigating a shooting incident this morning at the Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi after a Navy security team killed an Arab male. One sailor suffered minor injuries as two dozen shots were heard at the north gate of the air station. The latest on coronavirus and the story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with another set of bad economic numbers for the U.S. economy. Another 2.4 million Americans filing for initial unemployment benefits this past week, bringing the total number of people who lost their jobs so far during this pandemic to almost 40 million. The figures come amid a slew of bankruptcies as more companies announce layoffs. State labor departments have been working since the beginning of this pandemic to try to clear the backlogs of jobless claims after the surge of unemployment crashing the systems that were ill-prepared for the volume. And newly laid-off workers have overwhelmed unemployment offices in numerous states, leading to frustration and delays for those applying for and receiving aid and benefits. Well, today's job number is part of the virtual meeting that was posted online earlier today at thehill.com, with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin indicating that there is a strong likelihood another coronavirus relief bill will be needed as more states begin to gradually reopen and the economy struggles to stabilize. It came during a conversation with the editor-in-chief, Bob Cusack. It's been posted on its website. Here's a portion of that conversation.
2.4 million new jobless claims of unemployment this morning. Several Senate Republicans said yesterday they want to see some action now on the next relief package. Is another package necessary? And if so, when?
Well, let me just comment. First of all, I'm very sympathetic to the people who are not working at no fault of their own, because we've closed down the economy. And as we slowly reopen the economy in a safe way, we'll get people back to work. And in the current CARES package, there's several parts of it that are designed to help those American workers. One is obviously the PPP and getting people back to work through that process. The other is the economic impact payments, which are the direct payments. And then finally, the enhanced unemployment insurance. Which we do need to fix the quirk that in certain cases we're actually paying people more than they made. So we need to fix that. We're going to carefully review the next few weeks. I think there is a strong likelihood we will need another bill, but we just have $3 trillion we're pumping into the economy, and we're going to step back for a few weeks and think very clearly how we need to spend more money and if we need to do that.
That's from the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin earlier today. And on Capitol Hill, Republicans and Democrats remain divided over just how to tackle any additional legislation. The Senate in recess for the next 10 days. The House returns next week. Just last Friday, House Democrats did pass a $3 trillion relief package, but Senate Republicans have said that bill is dead on arrival in their chamber. Speaker Pelosi meeting with reporters earlier today on Capitol Hill.
Just what do you ascribe the majority leader's unwillingness to move forward with any additional relief package despite the desire of some in his conference to do so?
I think he will. I think he will. I think that he wants to put some things on the table. But right now, he has decided to obstruct us to get the support we need to give to our healthcare workers who need PPE. He's obstructing the will of the people to open our economy by having testing, tracing, treatment, and isolation where necessary. He's obstructing our ability to give states and localities, territories, and tribal entities the resources they need to stay open. These people are risking their lives to save lives, and now they may lose their jobs. Because of the opportunity, the money they have to spend to on the coronavirus, but also the opportunity lost, the revenue lost because of the virus. So this is, we have broad support across the country, Democratic and Republican leaders of towns and the rest. And the way the bill is, go to speaker.gov/Heroes Act and find out how your community, your state, your city, your town, your county benefits from this legislation. And you'll see why there's such broad support. You may not know it yet, but they will come to the table. And they will do so because it is absolutely essential. Our bill is focused, disciplined, and what is necessary to defeat this virus, but also to honor our heroes so that they can keep the jobs that are helping save lives in our country while we put money in the pockets of the those who are losing their jobs through no fault of their own. Also, to, again, support voting rights and doing voting at home, as well as supporting the Postal Service in order to do that. Also, to feed the American people, that moms are saying children under 12 are at the highest rate of food insecurity ever, and it's always been a problem in our country, now even exacerbated by the coronavirus. So it's about feeding people, feeding. How aren't they ashamed to say, I don't want to, as they have in the past few bills, I don't want to spend money to feed people in America? Our children who are losing their meals because they're not going to school, and sometimes that's the only place that they get a meal. Our seniors who depend on Meals on Wheels and other entities for food. It's so I don't know. You'd have to ask him why he doesn't want to feed the American people, that he doesn't want to put money in the pockets of the American people, why he doesn't want to honor our heroes in this fight against the virus, and why he does not want to defeat COVID-19, enemy of the American people.
Those comments from Speaker Pelosi. Now, a number of Republican senators have indicated that they want to move quickly on another measure, but the Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell has signaled his desire to move more slowly in order to first evaluate what is and isn't working from the previous relief bills, including more than $2 trillion in that bill signed by President Trump at the end of March. One point of division that has emerged, and you heard that earlier from the Treasury Secretary, is unemployment insurance. Senate Republicans yesterday adding that that $600 per week boost to unemployment insurance was part of the legislation passed in March, would not be included in the next bill. The concern, this money may mean that those out of work don't have as much of an incentive to get back into the marketplace. The Republican leader making these comments on the Senate floor.
COVID-19 has killed nearly 100,000 Americans. It has cost tens of millions their jobs. This is a generational tragedy. But in the midst of it, our country is pulling together. My home state of Kentucky is showing us how it's done. A glass producer transformed its operation to make protective shields for businesses. A high school principal named Evan Jackson invented a virtual commencement so graduates didn't go uncelebrated. Dr. Aaron Fraser, a pediatrician, has somehow found the spare time to stand up brand new food pantries. Restaurants are spreading hope and hospitality by donating meals to first responders. And one group of restaurants headquartered in Louisville called Texas Roadhouse has gone to great lengths to avoid layoffs. The founder gave up his salary, put his own money into a worker assistance fund. So far, they've spent $17 million on their workers, covering everything from healthcare premiums to bonuses. These past few months have been trying, trying indeed, but the American people have been truly inspiring. This spring, the Senate wrote and passed the largest rescue package in American history to try to help bridge this period. And this nation of nearly 330 million people put their lives on pause to protect our medical system. And it worked, Madam President. The American people did what Americans do. They got it done. We kept our health care system intact. We did not let this virus break us. And as far as we know, not one single American who needed a ventilator could not get one. We've not yet won the war, but the citizens of this nation have won an important battle. So what comes next? Sustaining this flattened curve will take vigilance, safely reopening schools, universities, and businesses will take care and leadership. The race for even more testing, therapeutics, and of course a vaccine will be one great national project.
From the Senate floor earlier today, and after threatening to block the Memorial Day recess, Senator Cory Gardner saying he now feels, quote, good about where things stand. That's because the Senate is now expected to approve a deal that would give small businesses hurt by this pandemic more time to spend their loans. Senator Gardner is facing a tough reelection this year in his home state of Colorado. Yesterday, he announced that he was willing to fight plans to head home for the next 10 days. But after Senate leaders made significant progress to give businesses more time to spend their Paycheck Protection Program, senators began heading out of town earlier today. Meanwhile, the president's top economic advisor expressing some uncertainty today about the economy and just how swiftly it would rebound from the downturn caused by this pandemic. Larry Kudlow is now striking a more cautious tone about the recovery. The director of the White House National Economic Council saying that there are some small glimmers of hope. He did voice optimism about improvement this summer, but he emphasized the coronavirus still poses what he describes as a unique and unpredictable threat to our nation's economy, adding the overall picture in the short term does appear bleak. You can see the full interview. It's available at WashingtonPost.com. In a phone conversation with the president, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer saying that she needs to focus on the true enemy of coronavirus. Michigan, as you know, has also been hit hard by a series of catastrophic floods in recent days, forcing her to declare a state of emergency. The president in Michigan today to visit a Ford auto plant. In recent days, he also has been encouraging protests against those lockdown orders. We saw some of them in Lansing. And just yesterday, the president tweeted that Michigan would be losing federal aid because the Secretary of State sent out applications across the state for residents who may be interested in obtaining an absentee ballot. By the way, the president voted in 2018 via absentee ballot. From CBS This Morning, this reaction from the Michigan governor.
We gotta stop demonizing one another and really focus on the fact that the common enemy is the virus, and now it's a natural disaster. This is what all of our focus should be on. I'm grateful for the fact that FEMA has been such a great partner, and that's what my message to him was. Let's try to focus on the true enemy, which is the virus and this natural disaster, and let's try to put everyone who has a platform on the same page of saying, let's do this and let's keep people safe in the process. That's always been my call, and that was what we talked about a little bit yesterday as well.
Well, the president made it very clear, Governor, that he's upset with your state. He said your Secretary of State had gone rogue, had mailed out absentee ballots. It turns out it's absentee ballot applications, and he threatened to withhold federal funding. He seems to have walked that back a little bit. But what is your response to that?
Well, you can only imagine how I feel about that. You know, we are in the midst of this global pandemic. We've lost 5,000 people in the state of Michigan. It's been devastating. We are at a point where we think it's safe to start re-engaging sectors of our economy. But then this flood hits and we've got to evacuate tens of thousands of people who are worried and scared on top of this global pandemic. And to have this kind of distraction is just ridiculous, to be honest. It's the threatening to take money away from a state that is hurting as bad as we are right now is just scary, and I think something that is unacceptable. And my hope is that today he will be in Michigan. He will see we are hardworking, good Americans. We need the support of our federal government as much as anybody else, if not more right now because of this added challenge. And that I'm hopeful that he comes away knowing that that's what's most important. No petty political stuff that he had going with the Secretary of State yesterday. We've got to be focused on doing the right thing right now on behalf of the people.
That with the Michigan governor on CBS This Morning earlier today. And as she indicated, the president was in Michigan. He did bring along a navy blue mask stamped with the presidential seal, but he refused to wear it in front of the cameras. CNN writes the following. It was another example of the president shrugging off the rules in place for others meant to guard against the coronavirus. Other company executives, including Bill Ford, the company's chairman, wearing a mask. Here's what the president said earlier today in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
And I'm honored to stand on a factory floor operated by the incredible workers of Ford Motor Company. You really are tremendously talented people. I know it. I'm not sure everybody in the world knows it, but a lot of people do, and they're all going to know it after this speech. but you are really talented, great people. Thank you very much for doing a great job. We know what it takes. Few people have that ability. Few. In our nation's war against the invisible enemy, the hardworking patriots here today answered the call to serve. You proved that the American worker is built for it, and you're built for tough. A great expression. You still use that expression, I think, Bill, right? That's a great expression. And you, let's see, can I use it for maybe myself? Built Trump tough. I don't know. They may say that's a takeoff. That's no good. You can't do that. And you've made really America proud, and you've made Ford proud. And America is very proud of Ford. Right here at the Rawsonville component plant, you're building a great medical arsenal to defeat the virus and cement America's place as the leading manufacturer and exporter of ventilators anywhere in the world. We're now getting calls from other countries, many other countries, both friend and foe, believe it or not. We get calls from foe, and we want to help them out, too. And we're making thousands and thousands of ventilators. And I think we really sort of started right over here. We got a call very early on from Bill and the group. And this is incredible what's happened and what you've done. With your help, not a single American who has needed a ventilator has been denied a ventilator, not one. And as you remember, we took over empty cupboards. The cupboards were bare. And we got into the business of ventilators and testing and all of these other things. Now we've done 14 million tests. The second country is at 3 million and less than 3 million. Germany, South Korea, and they've done a good job, but we're at 14 million tests, and the tests are the best of all. But on behalf of our entire nation, I want to say thank you very much. Thank you very much for doing a great job. Driven by the love and sweat and devotion of everyone here today, we're saving lives, we're forging ahead, and as of this week, the beating heart of the American auto industry is back open for business. That started right away, didn't it? It starts right now. And you have all those supply chains coming in. They're going to come through, because if they don't come through, just build the product right here, okay? Because, you know, that can happen, too. We heard that. It's a big story that we're starting with the cars now, and it's going to be a big success.
The president at the Ford plant earlier today in Michigan. On Wall Street, a pause today to any rally, the Dow losing 102 points, the NASDAQ was down 91, the S&P off 23. At WSJ.com, this headline, coronavirus is widening the retail divide. One example, Macy's sales falling 45%, expected to lose $1 billion this quarter. And joining us on the phone is Suzanne Kapner. She is following the story for the Wall Street Journal. These really are unprecedented times. My question is, what does this mean for the department stores and for the big box chains?
Well, you're really seeing a dichotomy that was playing out before the pandemic is just widening right now, where you have troubled retailers like the department stores, Macy's, JCPenney, are becoming even more troubled now. And, you know, with their stores closed for the past 6 weeks to 2 months, you know, their sales have dropped precipitously. They're recording, you know, huge losses. And on the flip side, you've got the big box chains like Walmart and Target that remained open, and customers really flocked to them for necessities, and their sales have been up double digits.
How are these stores basically trying to reevaluate their strategy, especially the large department stores like Macy's?
Well, Macy's said today that they're considering closing even more stores than they had planned. JCPenney recently said they're closing about a third of their stores. Nordstrom's closing a bunch of stores as well. So that's one way they're shrinking their footprint, because we've seen sales, you know, more sales move online, and people expect that to continue even after the pandemic, lessens.
And the numbers really are staggering. We talked about Macy's, but L Brands, which includes Victoria's Secret, sales down 37%. Do they expect an uptick as the economy gradually begins to reopen in the months ahead?
Well, they are seeing consumers come back, but slowly. So at Macy's, the stores that they've reopened, they're seeing about half the sales they normally would at this time of year. Same goes for Kohl's. So you are seeing shoppers come back, but they're coming back very slowly.
And of course, other chains like Pier 1 Imports shutting down completely. What will this mean for the future of America's malls, so much of a mainstay for the last 30 to 40 years?
Well, you're going to have a lot of vacant storefronts. And while this will ultimately probably be a good thing for the industry because we have far too much retail space in this country, it's going to involve a lot of pain for people losing their jobs, for companies going out of business in the near term.
The story available at WSJ.com. Suzanne Kapner of The Wall Street Journal, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, the New York Times has published details on a new report, what could have happened if governments acted sooner. The headline, "The Lockdown Delays Cost Lives." Here are the details. Quote, "If the United States had begun imposing social distancing measures 1 week earlier than it did back in March, about 36,000 fewer people would have died in the coronavirus outbreak. It's based on new estimates from Columbia University's disease models. And if the country had begun locking down cities and limiting social contact on March the 1st, that was 2 weeks earlier than most people began staying at home, the vast majority of the nation's deaths, about 83%, would have been avoided. Now, under that research scenario, about 54,000 fewer people would have died by early May. The enormous cost of waiting to take action reflecting the unforgiving dynamics of the outbreak that swept through American cities in early March. You can read the full story at nytimes.com. The president, meanwhile, is giving the World Health Organization 30 days to commit to substantial changes in how it operates, or he will make his hold on U.S. funding permanent. Now, the threat came in a letter that sharply criticizes the WHO and its response to COVID-19, as well as the organization's relationship with China. It was a four-page letter to the WHO director general and into the president writing, quote, "The World Health Organization has repeatedly made claims about the coronavirus that were either grossly inaccurate or misleading." At an event here in Washington, U.N. Ambassador Kelly Craft was asked about the WHO in this question from former State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
Let's start out talking about the WHO's annual assembly that was held this week. A resolution was passed approving an investigation into how the WHO handled the coronavirus outbreak. It calls for an impartial, independent, comprehensive evaluation of WHO's response. Yet the resolution says that this will not begin until the pandemic is actually over. So the question is, do you trust this process, this investigation, the process into the investigation?
You know, Heather, the most important thing that I think that President Trump has highlighted is letting the world know that the WHO ignored credible reporting on the virus and on the virus spreading in Wuhan. Matter of fact, they said that there was not a case of human-to-human transmission. And not only did they make this statement, is they continued to spread Chinese disinformation. And this has cost lives. It is continuing to cost lives and billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in trying to mitigate this process. And, you know, this has really demonstrated to us, the U.S., that the WHO and other member states really have not been up to the task to be able to mitigate, to prevent, to use their transparency. And, you know, they have a choice. They have a choice. They can become more transparent. They can change their ways if they would like to have the funding, the rest of the funding from the United States. Mm-hmm. My goal is to be able to restore WHO's independence. I mean, we want them to succeed because there are areas of the world where they are allowed in. They are mitigating the process. You know, the countries. And it's only to our benefit that they listen to President Trump, that they follow through, because they need to be, you know, fully transparent and fully accountable.
That from the UN Ambassador Kelly Craft earlier today. Meanwhile, the U.S. blame game towards China continued on the Senate floor. These remarks by Texas Republican Ted Cruz.
In Wuhan, 8 doctors who sounded the alarm about coronavirus in December were accused of spreading lies, arrested, and forced to sign documents claiming that they had made false statements that, quote, disturbed the public order. In reality, they were telling the truth. They were warning us. One of those doctors, Dr. Ai Fen, has been missing since late March. Another, Dr. Li Wenliang, has since died from the coronavirus. Dr. Li Wenliang, his wife was pregnant with the couple's second child when he died. And it's not just Chinese doctors who are paying the price for telling the truth. Journalists and activists who courageously spoke up, they're disappearing too. Xu Jiangrun, a Chinese law professor who spoke out about the Chinese government's handling of the coronavirus outbreak and criticized Chinese President Xi, he's been missing since February. Chen Shisha, a Chinese lawyer and journalist who went to Wuhan to report on what was happening there, has been missing since February 6th. Fang Bin, a Wuhan businessman and journalist who reported on the number of bodies piling up outside a Wuhan hospital, has been missing since February 9th.
That from Senator Ted Cruz of Texas on the Senate floor earlier today. Before heading to Michigan earlier today, the president telling reporters that he intends to take what he calls a very strong position on church reopenings as the country begins to recover from this pandemic. More from the South Lawn at the White House.
Mosques, yeah, including mosques, including mosques. Yes, I wish them well, very well. Go ahead.
Talk about the AstraZeneca an award, $1 billion for 400 million doses of a potential new vaccine. How confident are you that one will be ready by the fall?
Well, I think we have a lot of, you have AstraZeneca, which is a great company, and you have others, Johnson & Johnson. We have a lot of things happening on the vaccine front, on the therapeutic front. If you look at therapeutically, we're doing great. And on the cure front, which is the next step. I think we have tremendous things. That announcement I heard came out this morning, that's a very positive announcement in addition to all of the other announcements. We are so far ahead of where people thought we'd be, but therapeutically is very interesting what's going on in cure. So you're going to have a lot of big announcements over the next week or two.
With Marine One in the background, the president earlier today before heading to Ypsilanti, Michigan. Meanwhile, Baltimore Mayor Jiak Young saying that he hopes the president would change his mind about visiting Baltimore's Fort McHenry National Monument this Memorial Day and instead saying he should remain at the White House. The administration announcing that the president and first lady would be visiting Baltimore on Monday, which is Memorial Day. Mayor Young said that he wished that the president would set a better example as Baltimore remains under a stay-at-home order due to the pandemic. The mayor saying, quote, I wish that the president, as our nation's leader, would set a positive example and not travel during this holiday weekend. Meanwhile, here in Washington, Baltimore native and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from California with these remarks as the Memorial Day weekend approaches.
Well, I think I thank you for that question because everybody wants out. You know, with all the love that we have for each other and the rest, we can't even see each other. You know, I can't wait till I can hug my grandchildren again. But that will have to wait. I would just say people have to be very careful. They should wear masks. These people who don't wear masks, the mask is not to protect you. The mask is to protect other people. So when you don't wear the mask, what are you saying? I don't care about you. But I hope you're wearing a mask and care about me. The masks are very, very important. Spacing, very, very important. So there could be ways for people to engage. I do not recommend any large public events. I think that that's dangerous still. But there could be a way to have discipline, distance, and masks, hand washing, all of those things. And there are ways to, again, have a family meal over the Memorial weekend, keeping our distances and not double-dipping into the guacamole. That would not be a good idea. By the way, it's never a good idea. No double dipping, but especially maybe we'll all pick up some very good habits from all of this. But, you know, we respect the enthusiasm that people have to get out and get some fresh air and the rest. But they should not do it rationalizing that it doesn't matter how they do it. It does matter. And that's why I would hope that the president and the vice president all would wear a mask. They don't wear a mask. Why not? Other people should, so they should set an example. They have doctors around them all the time to minister to their very sneeze. But everybody else does not have that.
That from Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, earlier today, meeting with reporters on Capitol Hill, and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser announcing today that the nation's capital could embark on what she called a staged reopening as early as next Friday, but only if the downward trends in coronavirus hold in the coming days. She held a news conference on Capitol Hill, and Mayor Bowser cautioning that barring any peaks in COVID-19 cases, the disease that has been caused by the novel coronavirus, the city will be in a posture to begin restarting its economy again beginning late next week. Meanwhile, Facebook says it will allow many of its employees to work from home permanently. That from Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook chief executive. He announced it during a staff meeting that was, of course, live streamed on his Facebook page. The social media giant sending its employees home back in March as the pandemic began to spread in the U.S. Within a decade, as many as half of the company's more than 45,000 employees would be able to work from home. This note on campaign 2020, a new poll out today showing that former Vice President Joe Biden's lead over the president is increasing. A new head-to-head survey from Quinnipiac University shows Biden up by 11 points. The survey found that voters support Biden 50% to 39% for President Trump. That same survey showing that 56% of those questioned disapprove of the way the president is handling this pandemic. Now, even before COVID-19, Time magazine writes about the class of 2020 coming to age at a time of fear and uncertainty. From 9/11 to the 2008 Great Recession and the upheaval in our politics, we'll talk with Time's cover story author about the cover story Generation Pandemic. She'll join us in just a moment. But first, these words recently by award-winning actor Tom Hanks to one graduating class this year.
I'm here to say congratulations. Congratulations to you, chosen ones. And I am calling you the chosen ones because you have been chosen in many ways. First, by the temperament and discipline you've lived by the creative fires that are inside of you and the instinctive lunges of your desires. There is something about you, all of you, in your upbringing and your background and your conscious memories and your ongoing mysteries, something that has driven you to complete your choice, your courses, and achieve your selected challenges and cross the Rubicon of your time there, your studies at Wright State. You succeeded because of the aid and the love of others that are in your lives, without a doubt. But you succeeded mostly because you and you alone chose to do so. You are the chosen ones.
That from actor Tom Hanks to the class of 2020 at Wright State University and to the cover story of Time magazine, Generation Pandemic. Joining us on the phone is national correspondent Charlotte Alter. She is in Brooklyn. And this is one graduation that these students will not soon forget.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
The essence of your piece, titled Unlucky Graduates, what did you learn from those who are receiving their diploma after 4 years of college this year?
So, you know, this has been obviously an incredibly disruptive moment for them. I mean, college in-person commencement ceremonies are being canceled and postponed across the country. There were a lot of campuses where students, you know, thought that they would have their senior spring and thought that they would have a couple more months to, you know, say goodbye to their friends and create these memories that are often the sort of last and it's often the most kind of powerful memories of your college experience. And these students just felt like things had been really cut off for them. And some said it was eerie and even unsettling to just sort of like abruptly leave in the middle of their senior year and not really get the closure that they had expected.
And one of the quotes that stands out, and you talk to a lot of students, but Simone Williams, a graduate of Florida A&M University, that, quote, "We stepped into the world as it was starting to fall apart."
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I sort of try to explore in this story is that it's not really just about missing parties or not getting to celebrate with your parents or, you know, not having the ceremony or the, you know, the hugs with your friends. It's about the broader professional and political implications of graduating into a world where, you know, with sky high unemployment, a looming recession, and you know, the youngest graduates are in many ways the least likely to, you know, be able to get a job in this climate, and also are falling through a big hole in the social safety net because many of them are not eligible for unemployment benefits, and many of them are not getting stimulus checks if they've been, you know, listed as dependents on their parents' taxes.
And you begin the piece that really kind of sums up what you learned in talking to these students. Quote, college graduation is one of life's last clean transitions, a final passage from adolescence to adulthood. College is one of the things in life that ends with a fresh start, except when it doesn't.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is I remember thinking this even in the years after I graduated from college. It's kind of the last thing that is supposed to end nicely, right? Most other major experiences in your life end with something gone wrong. You know, relationships either end with a breakup, or if you're lucky enough to marry somebody, you know, ultimately somebody dies, right? Most jobs end with either somebody quits or somebody gets fired or laid off. Most other major relationships and major kind of milestones or events in your life after college don't end with a nice bow on top in the way that college does. So in some ways, a college graduation is like the last clean ending before kids are sort of spat out into the world.
We are talking with Charlotte Alter, national correspondent for Time Magazine. So, as we said at the top of our conversation, this is a graduation they will not soon forget. How is it shaping the class of 2020?
Well, you know, they're graduating into an incredibly difficult professional climate. You know, there are the number of job postings for new entry-level jobs, like the kind of jobs that a new college graduate would go for, have plummeted 75%. On ZipRecruiter. So it's really slim pickings out there. But more broadly, I mean, already this was a cohort that was kind of disaffected and a little bit skeptical. I mean, think about what their lives have been like until now. They were, you know, just a couple years old on 9/11. They were, you know, maybe in fifth or sixth grade during Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. You know, that was a campaign that was really important for millennials who are older than them. As soon as they get to college, Donald Trump is elected president, and then they graduate into a global pandemic. So these were kids, you know, when I spoke to them, I was struck by this idea that they are really skeptical of institutions. They don't feel like the government is working the way that it should be. It's not because they think the government is doing too much. It's that they think the government isn't doing enough. 7 in 10 voters in Gen Z, which is the generation that the class of 2020 is a part of, 7 in 10 believe that they want the government to do more to solve problems. And that includes Gen Z Republicans. More than half of Gen Z Republicans want the government to do more. So this is a generation that has really seen kind of the failures of government inaction on issues from school shootings to climate change. And they are really, you know, this is a moment, kind of almost a make or break moment for them, because if there is not a big forceful recovery and a big forceful response that can restore their faith in the American government's ability to solve big problems, I think it's going to be hard to convince them down the line to even believe in this system anymore.
So you think this is a pivot point that potentially could change our politics?
Yeah, I do. I mean, this generation was already losing faith in the American system even before this crisis. I mean, these are the same kids who, you know, grew up almost every week or every other week hearing reports of a school shooting. These are the March for Our Lives kids. This is that generation. These are the same kids who grew up hearing reports of catastrophic climate change that would affect their kids and, you know, possibly make life uninhabitable in the span of their lifetimes. The same kids who went on the global climate strike. So they already feel like the government isn't doing enough to solve big problems. So then to add COVID and the economic devastation of COVID on top of that, this might be, for many of these young people, the last chance to prove that government can work for them. I do think that they're also really looking to this next election. I mean, most of the young people that I spoke to don't really hold out any hope for the Trump administration. You know, Trump has very high unapproval ratings with this disapproval ratings with this cohort. They're not really looking to the Trump administration, but they are looking to Election Day. So that will be interesting to see how that plays out.
A global crisis changed their lives. How they respond will change the world. Charlotte Alter, national correspondent for Time magazine, the cover story out today. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we focus on COVID-19 and the road ahead on our podcast, The Weekly. Ed Yong writes about America's patchwork approach to this pandemic and told us that if you're not directly affected by the virus, your mindset is very different.
Yeah, I think one of the big predictors of how people think and behave during this pandemic is whether they have personally been affected by it. And by that, I mean personally affected by the disease. Either they have had it or they know friends and family who have had it. And if any of those things are true, they tend to take things a lot more seriously and they are more supportive of things like social distancing, restrictions, wearing masks and so on. And I think we're going to see a pattern where as the pandemic moves across the country and hits places that had previously not really felt it, so a lot of suburbs, rural areas, places in the American heartland, we're going to see attitudes in those places shifting too. People who previously only heard about the pandemic on the nightly news will now start to hear it from their friends and families, and that is going to change their mind.
Ed Yong's full essay is available at theatlantic.com, and better yet, check out The Weekly at cspan.org/podcast. This program, also Washington Today, available at the same site. We thank you for joining us for this Thursday edition, one day before the birthday of our executive producer, Shannon Rice. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Stay safe, enjoy the rest of your evening, and Shannon, happy, happy birthday.